The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Brian Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Ralph Macchio is best known for his portrayal of Daniel LaRusso in the 1984 film The Karate Kid. This iconic piece of pop culture has spawned a slew of sequels and the number one ranked Netflix show, Cobra Kai. Phrases such as wax on, wax off, Daniel's son, and sweep the leg are part of the cultural lexicon. Macchio is also acclaimed for his performances in the Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders, Pony Boy, and the classic My Cousin Vinny. Yo. As director and producer, he has a diverse list of credits. He joins us with his new memoir, Waxing On, The Karate Kid and Me. Tonight, he'll be joined in conversation with Jason Freeman, a producer and editor in the Author Events office. Please join me in welcoming our guest to the Free Library.
What a crowd. You guys are awesome, man. It's like, this is amazing.
Well, you guys don't need me. First of all, we were like, you know, good audience. I was like, I think there's going to be a good reception out here. So
you never know. Coming around the corner. It was awesome. So, you guys are amazing.
Ralph Macchio, Philadelphia. Hey. Ralph Macchio. Oh. Okay, enough pandering, everybody. So, welcome, first of all. I think Philadelphia in general is a good place to start because every Philadelphian tries to turn something into a Philadelphia connection. But in this case, there's actually a pretty good one. I'd like to talk about the Rocky Karate Kid connection.
Uh-huh.
And do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So John Avildsen, who directed Rocky, won an Academy Award. And then he directed, of course, Karate Kid 1, 2, and 3. And so I was lucky enough to get the paperback advanced copy of this, so you guys are going to enjoy it. I really love, there's a scene early in a book, and you know, in many ways, this guy helped, you know, make your career.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great scene where you meet him. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh yeah, meeting John Avildsen for mm-hmm. the first time. Yes, and he would always affectionately call the Karate Kid the Karaki Kid. Early on, I walked into his apartment. I got the call to audition for this movie called The Karate Kid, and I'm like, what is it, a cartoon? Is that a real title? I thought it was a placeholder, you know? And maybe I thought perhaps I might, if I got the part, would have to carry it for the rest of my life. So maybe that was what I was thinking at the time. I went to his apartment on Upper West Side of New York and walked in there. Was you know, nervous as always. I had the scene down. It was the you actually could see the scene. It's on YouTube. It's my audition is on YouTube now. John put it up years later, and it's really kind of cool to watch. So my book comes with visual aids. That's what I like to say. But I walked in, and he was, you know, was holding this big camera, this old big JVC video camera, and just shooting every capturing everything I was doing, and I was a little self-conscious at first because I wasn't yet reading the scene, you know, but I later realized he was just capturing behavior, capturing, you know, how I carried myself, what my mannerisms were, which is a great thing, especially with a young actor. You get, you get to see authentically what they are before it's like action, and all of a sudden they start acting like this, you know, so you get to discover that. And I read the scene, and he talks me through what happens in the scene. It's when he first realizes that Mr. Miyagi is a human Yoda and saved him from the guys at this, you know, the skeleton fight at the fence. And I read the scene once, and he goes, he said to me, I can't guarantee you this part, but if I were you, I'd start taking karate lessons. And I was just like, you know, you never hear that in the room. You usually hear like, okay, we'll get back to you, nice job, or adjustments. And I remember just sprinting down from 80-something Street to Penn Station, New York, and taking the train back to Long Island, where the suburbs where I lived, hoping that the call would come in. And it did. It was special. And I grew up, Rocky was such a big part of my childhood. I mean, we all, you know, you could not, there was, in 1976 and on, there was never a staircase outside a building that I wasn't running up, you know, pretend. And the truth is, on that train ride back from the audition, I'm starting to fantasize that I'm going to have this part, you know, and who knew that I'd be sitting here in 2022 still talking about it. So it was the beginning of all that time.
Yeah, and one thing that I think is wonderful, Ed, you know, you're talking about what you're wearing when you go into that, and I'm like, yeah, that was, you know, that's 40 years ago. He didn't remember what he was wearing, but he videotaped not just that, but everything, and I'm thinking to myself, what a gift,
yeah,
just for the personal nostalgia of your life, but what mm-hmm. a gift for a memoirist.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah,
like you could actually go back and see that. Also, in the book, you said you really knew it was yours when you saw the name change. I did not know this, and I'm an aficionado. You saw the name change from
Danny Weber to Daniel LaRusso. That was kind of, I mean, it was written as Danny Weber, and I was like, all right, I could be a Weber, I guess. You know, I guess so. And I remember when I did my screen test with Pat Morita. I mean, that's when the magic, that's when it was game over, when Pat and I got together. That I call the chapter I focus on called Soulful Magic, and that was Pat Morita in that role. And I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I got the script after I finally got the option pickup. I had the offer, but I didn't have the part until the screen test, so you have to kind of jump through some hoops for a couple of weeks. And then the script came in, and it said, it had all crossed out, and it said LaRusso. And there was one time, there's one place you'll see in the book that it was not corrected properly, so you see my handwriting. I crossed it out, and I wrote LaRusso with horrible penmanship, which I still have to this day.
Yeah, and I definitely, it's an excellent segue because, you know, I was 6 when this came out. And do the math, I said I got to do this interview because we're both blessed with eternal youth. But for me in the movies, the real heart, and what's the real heart of the book for me in a way I love, is the friendship, the mentorship, all of that with Pat Morita.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's a big question, but, you know, and I was trying to really, you know, think about specifically phrasing it. It's a big question, but what did he mean to your life? You know, there's so much here in it. So if you
yeah,
just wanna...
I mean, initially it was, they were looking for who was going to play Miyagi, who was going to play this sensei rooted in Goju-Ryu, traditional Okinawan karate, and yet have a sense of humor but be the karate master. No one thought Arnold from Happy Days was going to be that guy. Myself included. I was like, really? Arnold? Like, Bahaha, Fonzie, Richie. And I'm like, I didn't necessarily see it. And the reason I bring this up, and for any young folk out there as well, you think, be careful what you think you know, right? Because I was like, oh, he's not going to be able to, you know, that's not the right match, you know? And the producer said the same thing. He knew Pat Morita from his stand-up comedy days in the Catskills, and he was like, there's no way this guy's going to be in the picture. As Jerry Weintraub, I love doing Jerry Weintraub. He's a great, great producer. He's no longer with us, but anyway, so, and the studio was saying the same thing. And then John Avildsen just put a tape in, a VHS tape in Jerry Weintraub's, VCR and said, this is the guy, and everything just stopped. I didn't see that. I was just brought in like a few days later to read with Pat, and I had the same preconceived notions which the irony of that is I was typecasting Pat Morita in my mind, and essentially a couple of years later I would be fighting my own typecast as being Daniel LaRusso to everyone and nothing else. So it's that's why I say, you know, be careful what you think you know. And what was so amazing, as soon as I walked in that room and met Pat, there was no Arnold from Happy Days was nowhere to be found. He had the authenticity, he had such dedication to the responsibility of playing a Japanese American, in this case an Okinawan American, and he wanted to do justice to that. And but he also, being a comic, knew where all the humor was. You know, J.C. Penney, 398. He knew how to say what kind of belt you have. And so there was a natural give and take and an effortless ease of the dance and the language. Credit the writing. I mean, you need the writing first and foremost. If it's not on the page, it's not on the stage, right? But to elevate all of that, it was our instinctive chemistry and mutual respect for each other that became what is Mr. Miyagi and Daniel in an ultimate cinema partnership that still resonates today. And even in the Cobra Kai series, that was something highly important to me going in when they pitched that concept. As I said, I need to have Miyagi woven through this show and his presence be somewhere throughout, and the writers do a brilliant job of it. And I think it's, you know, people stop me all the time and say that's some of their favorite moments. They get emotional because it harkens back to that nostalgia and that warm embrace, that comfort food of something that meant a great deal. And then stories could do that, and movies can do that, you know.
Yeah, and I want to get to 80s nostalgia and a lot of this. But the book is, I don't know, maybe some of you started reading it already. It's so conversational. It's your voice. Like, I felt like, you know, you were sitting at the table with me in the coffee shop, you know, telling me stories, and you're doing imitations of you're doing the Jerry Weintraub voice.
That's awesome. That was
like
the goal, man.
You do, like, Pat Morita on your answering machine and stuff like
right.
that.
That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be authentic me and honest me, you know, even with some of my shortcomings and things I would have, you know, maybe done differently, although I still feel, for the most part, I always say I kind of, what you get from the book, or what I'd like people to get from the book, is through all of it and the ups and downs, and some of it was not always simple or easy, I kind of wound up on my feet and had that balance, if you will, the Miyagi-isms, you can hear them all night long, going forward, because there are life lessons in this movie that keep giving back today.
Yeah, you know? And something I like that you do in the book, and I'm about to do it, we're going to get to that. In so many chapters, you're like, okay, here's Elizabeth Shue. I'm going to talk about Elizabeth Shue later. You say in the book, and there's always, it's like, it pays off in a good way.
It doesn't pay off. So, I worry, when I was doing that, I thought by design, you know, I would, because I'd mention a story, say something about Billy Zabka, and I mentioned about him, and then I mentioned about Elizabeth Shue, or so I said, but I'll get to that later. But back to this now.
Yeah.
I thought that was a cool thing to do. I guess the only time it isn't a cool thing to do is if you don't deliver on the promise.
Right. Right.
Like, he never got to it.
Right.
So I think I dotted all those I's and crossed the T's there.
Right. Well, just so everybody knows, by the way, we're doing like a half hour, so I could do Miyagi questions all night, but you guys prepare yours. There's going to be a half hour of you guys asking questions too. So I'll move on to truly my hero, Billy Zabka. Johnny
awesome.
Lawrence.
Gotta love him. How great is he in the Cobra Kai show, man? He just kills it.
You know, it's like, it's, everybody wants to be Daniel. It's hard to be Johnny Lawrence. You know, nobody wants to play Fredo. Everybody wants to, you know? And turning it, and, you know, I like all of you, am a fan of Cobra Kai, but I was, you know, I wanted to go back in kind of fresh. I watched the first episode today, and it's brilliant because the first three quarters of it is just him, and you're seeing the whole thing from his
perspective.
And you guys know that, and that's all on the screen, but I think there's such a richness to knowing that you guys have that relationship on screen, but you've been friends in your lives for so long, and there's so many nice moments there. Can you talk about Billy Zabka for
me? Well, listen, the chapter that I wrote, I mean, he's throughout the whole book, and the book jumps time and space to Cobra Kai. Every chapter has a little Cobra Kai sprinkling in it. Some of it has more than others. The first third of the book is kind of the making of the Karate Kid movie and the untold stories and how things and the iconic moments, how they happen. Then there's the afterlife after the crane takes flight, if you will. And then the sort of drier times of like, okay, what am I going to do now? And then there's the lessons of the Karate Kid. So that's kind of the three acts of the book. But with Billy, you know, I ended working with him in Karate Kid, you know, the original film, and I remember looking back and saying, well, at least I never have to see that guy again, you know? It's all he did is kick my ass every day. You know, there wasn't a lot of dialogue. It was more, you know, you couldn't leave well enough alone.
He's so good at it, though.
He's amazing.
He's so good at it that he had to do it in Back to School.
Yeah,
and you know.
And Just One of the Boys, everything.
Yeah.
But anyway, so so we hadn't seen each other. The movies ended, you know, and I went on to other things, and he did his thing, and it was, we hadn't seen each other in 20 years, and where I saw him was at Pat Morita's funeral, in a service, a memorial service, and it was a real poignant shift. It was like, I write in the book, I don't want to give too much away, but it moves me seeing him there, because we were both, for the first time, on the same side of the mat. Mourning a personal friend. And from that point on, we started talking and becoming, you know, he directed some short films. I directed a short film. He was nominated for an Oscar for a short film that he did. And I had my film at Sundance. So now we start talking as filmmakers. And a friendship built. And he would always say, I think there's more meat on the bones of our two characters. And I was less embracing of that because we didn't really have the idea. He just felt that there could be something there, because I just kept thinking, okay, now I was probably like late 40s, really, a rematch? I can't, you know, tying my shoes hurts, you know. And now I'm doing it every week on Cobra Kai. But so we just, became more and more friendly. And it's interesting because it's like when you're connected to an entity like a movie that has, you know, become that iconic or meant so much to you folks or everyone around the world. You live through that prism, but Billy and I live it from totally opposite angles, right? So then we, you know, start to, you're connected, but you're viewing things differently. And then when Cobra Kai came around, I write to this at the moment where we realized we had something special. Is in our first scene acting together on the show, it was, we just had this silent conversation that there was all this depth and wisdom underneath all these years from being connected to the to these characters and walking in the skins of these characters. Now jumping 30 years later, it had such depth and breadth to it that we couldn't even put it into words. And it was, and it's what you see in the Cobra Kai series. When Johnny and Daniel are together, La Russo, right, they say. I think the fans, they come up with all this stuff. It's you people. It elevates the show, you know, and it's just sort of the tentpole that holds it up. It's really quite wonderful. And the Karate Kid universe is loaded with that since day one.
Yeah. I love you call it the Miyagi-verse.
The Miyagi-verse. I do call it the Miyagi-verse.
Well, you know, you're doing all the great segues for me. Just a couple of minutes.
It's a tango, baby.
It's a delicate dance. Yes. What I find really interesting, and you're touching on this some, and I do want to talk about Big E the 80s before we get to the end of it. But what I think is so interesting about the show is it's gray. It's ambivalent in a way that, you know, 80s movies never
black
are.
And,
you're fleshing out these characters. And there is nostalgia. You know, I go back again, was watching the first episode, and Johnny's watching Iron Eagle again. I was like, me too. not the drinking part. And, you know, there's that nostalgia, but the characters are so gray and interesting, yeah. And there's such an evolution for them. Have you, the writers, producers, directors, is that a constant, you know, sort of tension, struggle to flesh these characters out and yet, you know, keep the characters true?
Yeah, I mean, there's and I write to that a little bit, the push-pull of the creative collaboration with Cobra Kai. I mean, you could imagine what it was like for me when they pitched Cobra Kai. I said no to the Karate Kid remakes or reboots or for years because it just, you know, I mean, not that it's the Mona Lisa, that film, but I didn't want to mess with it, you know? I didn't want to, it was always easier to say no and let the legacy stand. And these guys come in, these great writers, and they're super Karate Kid fans, and they're pitching me a show called Cobra Kai. I was like, say what? And they're like, and we're going to redeem Johnny Lawrence, and you're going to be a car dealer. That lives off his one kick but is happily married. And I was like, whoa, you know, so that was I had to process all that out. So as we, and then I spoke to them about the Miyagi element and those things. And I knew it was a smart idea. I had just seen Creed. Here's another connection, right? And Creed did a great job of getting into the Rocky universe without making Rocky 7, right? So it informed me that, okay, come through the eyes of the bully. Whatever happened to this bully? Whatever happened to the kid who got kicked in the face and was, you know, humiliated? Why was he that way? You know, no such thing as bad student, only bad teacher, right?
Right.
So I'll be, you know, all these Miyagi-isms will keep coming. But, you know, so it is active with Cobra Kai in finding those gray areas, so it stretches out the story, the narrative. Every character could have a little good, a little bad. They fall, as long as they're falling forward, you know. That's the thing we discuss. You know, Johnny Lawrence and Daniel LaRusso both have good intentions. They can't get out of their own way. They clash, you know, and it's so entertaining. We talk about it being the Ross and Rachel of the show. You know, you love them together and you love them when they're fighting, you know. And so, but those are story, narrative story points that keep the ball up in the air. And the other thing with Cobra Kai that really attracted me to it was the way the writers fleshed out the young cast, you know, the next generation cast. Samantha, Robbie, Miguel, all those guys, Hawk, and all that. They've become their own next generation Karate Kids. And then it never loses sight, as zany as sometimes Cobra Kai gets. Karate in the Valley is the most important thing in the world. I mean, just, you know, move to another town and take up a different sport. But we love that. We love that it's the most important thing in the world. And taking down Terry Silver is paramount. Right. You know? They love that. But on the same token, it's still about bullying, mentorship, fathers and sons, overcoming obstacles, doing what's right, you know, and those themes, those human themes from the original Karate Kid are the same themes that are touched upon. And that's, the focus has to stay there. Otherwise, it becomes just a one-off idea. And, you know, and the streaming services allow to longer narratives. So we're going to try to get you a season 6. We're waiting on it.
Yeah, it is true. It's like in the Valley, they speak in hushed tones about the 1984 Karate. It's like, so let's talk about the 80s. What I find interesting in the book is that, you know, you were just working all the time. And you're like, I didn't really get to experience this,
right?
You know, in the way that we did. But you do have some really interesting thoughts on the way the movies look, the way the aesthetic, and why the themes of these things. There are a lot of kids out here, but I see a lot of people older than me. Like, these movies are important to us. Why? What is it that endures about, not just endures, that's blossoming again and again, the proverbial bonsai, you know, blossoming again and again. What is it about the themes, the characters, the stories?
Well, for Karate Kid, I said it before, I think it's because it works on a human level. You really, I mean, that film at that time, I mean, Daniel LaRusso in The Karate Kid was the every kid next door who kind of had no business winning anything, really. And he had, you know, he represented a piece of all of us, you know, a fatherless teen, single parenting, moving to a different town, you know, starting anew, bullying, mentorship. These are all themes that haven't gone away. They're all still relevant. So I think the fact that story and, you know, worked on a human level is why it sustains. And then you add catching flies with chopsticks, waxing cars or karate moves, get him a body bag. You know, I mean, it's just, it's become pop culture. Yeah. You know, sweep the leg and all that stuff is just, you know, it's part of the American lexicon. I can't go, you know, if I go to, you know, an Eagles game or you know, and you put me up on the Jumbotron, people start yelling, sweep the leg, come on. The kick was legal. No, it wasn't. It was illegal. You know, it's become, so those are some of the reasons. But, you know, and then, right, the 80s for me, going back to your initial start of this question, was I was living in a bubble. I don't remember, you know, I was just working so much at that time. I mean, you know, I remember Michael Jackson. I remember the Springsteen's tour. I remember, you know, the movies of that time. But it was a simpler time, I guess. Yeah. I don't know, you know.
And you get to it. By the way, I love the chapter titles. You know, such the Zabka experience, the crane takes flight, the 80s of it all, frozen in time. And towards the end, finding balance and do-overs and waxing. Mm-hmm. I found it to be really poignant, the most poignant part of the book. Mm-hmm. And obviously there are instructive moral qualities here. And you really spell out, too, that it is about, you know, three things, mentorship, bullying, wish fulfillment. But mm-hmm. it keeps falling under that umbrella of mentorship, mm-hmm. and I think it's easy to tell kids what, you know, you've learned out of it. What do you have for us wannabe adults that you've learned about, you know, balancing your career and your family and all of these other things?
Yeah, I do write to the last few chapters of the book are more of a personal dive into how those themes have affected me in my life and the ups and downs of all that and how I've been able to fortunately navigate any of the pitfalls. I joke in the book, I say I am the anti E True Hollywood story. You know, I'm not the crash and burn to redemption. I mean, I've had my difficult times and challenges in life, as we all do, but somehow by keeping one foot in and one foot out, I've found that way to balance it, and one foot in Hollywood and one foot out. But I also lost opportunities by doing that, and probably chances to maybe further my career at a certain time. But therein lies the balance that works. So I'm lucky and blessed. It's not all by design. Like, everyone's like, boy, you did it perfectly. I was out of work as an actor, and I got to raise my kids with my wife, and I was there at all the, for the most part, at all the big landmark events of your children growing up. That wasn't totally by design. I would have liked to have been in a few movies or TV series at the time, or, you know, directing something. But that was, you know, that's the way it panned out. I mean, I blame my parents for my level-headedness. I'm doing these quotes again. Because my wife and kids might disagree with the fact that I'm calling myself level-headed. But, you know, my upbringing was the foundation, you know, that I had. I always had a safe place with my family. I was close with my mom. And my wife I met when I was 15 years old, and we're married 35 years. So, and my kids, which I will segue to, because this is the cool thing I always like to mention. I never thought that something such a big part of my life back then would be such a massive part of their lives today. And I'll leave you with a story. I've told this on one or two talk shows, so you might have heard it, but it's a good one. My son's about 4 or 5 years old. My mom must have dropped off a bin full of Tiger Beat 16 magazine, whatever I was on, you know, all those teen magazines. And she's like, you know, she's like emptying out the garage. And my son had no, at this time, at this point, it's like the late 90s. So my cousin Vinny has come and gone. My kids are young, you know, Nickelodeon and like Hannah Montana and Drake and Josh were the shows they were watching, High School Musical, whatever. My son comes running in the house because my, you know, kids sort of heard that I did a movie or two at that point. And he comes running in the house with the teen magazine. He goes to his sister. He goes, "Dad was huge and we missed it." And so I love telling that story because he was like, he couldn't believe this. My daughter had a hunch. She was older and she sort of got it when I was at a Planet Hollywood here and there and asked questions like, why does everyone come up to daddy and stand on one leg and do this? What does that mean? You know, so after time, so what's so cool about this now is this Cobra Kai show, and just even the book, when they read the book, they are just, they're sharing a piece of my life, but it's relevant now. So it's nostalgia, yet contemporary, and that's very, very rare.
Yeah.
And it's really awesome. They champion the show and all this stuff, and they're adults now, but it's really, you know, so it's another blessing on top of it that the gift of the Karate Kid is given to me, and it just keeps on giving, and just like, you know, being here with you guys, it's amazing.
It is, it is. Yes, but, you know, still show your son that video when you get home of all these people going absolutely
bananas.
Yeah,
I'm totally doing it. Believe me, that's going to arrive.
You got some cash out.
Yeah, yeah, darn right.
Well, and you know, it's nice hearing you say all that. And what I like about the book, particularly for a memoir, it's so about other people. You know, it's about the other people who came along and you know, and that you missed. And it's an engaging read, but you avoided a lot of those 80s movie star pitfalls.
Right.
Was it Rob Lowe on the Outsiders? You had the sign on your door.
Yeah, I always had a do not disturb on my door. You know, I would study my lines, get to bed early. I was just so boring. But I mean, The Outsiders was so huge to me because I read that book when I was 12, and got some greasers in the house. I love it. Doing it for Johnny. It was that was so big to me, and it was Francis Ford Coppola. It was. You know, so I took it very seriously. And then Rob Lowe said, he goes, I'm going to get you a T-shirt that says, do not disturb. Because every time we're going out, we see that your room says, do not disturb on it. I avoided, all the pitfall, the drugs and alcohol that was going on at that time so freely. And I go back to my parents and my own sensibilities. And then I go back to my sports teams. The Philadelphia fans are going to be PO'd right now. But
quit while you're ahead.
But no, come on. We got a good thing going here. So in the 80s, my New York Islanders was my team. Well, that's a tough one for Philly because of that. Yeah, right. So they won 4 straight Stanley Cups. The Mets were on a run with 84 and 86 they won. And so when I wasn't working, I just wanted to go back to New York to go to the games. And maybe if I didn't, I would be walking down Sunset Boulevard with a bottle of scotch going into the Viper room. I don't know. I have no idea, but fortunately, I just avoided that. It was, and like I said earlier, there were opportunities that I might have missed by not staying in it during those times, but it, you know, worked out beautifully, but not all by design, you know, so.
We're about to get to your questions. I have 3 speed round questions.
Oh, boy, did I have speed round.
Favorite, well, you mentioned him several times.
Make it
favorite
like,
Springsteen song slash album you mentioned several times in the book?
I would say Thunder Road is my favorite song, so I would have to go with Born to Run, but there's so many others.
Okay. Favorite Rocky film, and you can't say Part 1.
What?
Favorite non-Part 1 Rocky film?
That's a good question. I will say Rocky 2, even though it got a little big, but yo, Adrian, I did it. My next to my kid being born is the greatest night of my life. I'm just like, wow. So,
we also would
but
have
But I didn't mind
Rocky
Balboa. I did like Rocky Balboa, actually. Very much so.
Favorite non-Miyagi-verse martial arts film?
Ooh, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Did shooting the film Crossroads give you permanent guitar skills?
Permanent novice guitar skills, okay. Neophyte guitar skills. And I got to keep that guitar, which is awesome. That telecast, I know, people
that
love
cool.
that.
And my last question, and you're among friends and we'll keep it quiet, was it an illegal kick?
Okay, now I gotta pull up a lounge chair now. No, listen, the kick was legal. Here's my theory, and I brought this. I did this with Fallon on the Tonight Show. I went down the breakdown. He was defending himself from an attack. And so funny because they said illegal kick in the whole first season of Cobra Kai and the tournament. Everybody's kicking everybody in the face. It's karate for defense only, and he was defending himself. He wasn't attacking Johnny Lawrence. He was stopping himself from being attacked. So therein lies my opinion that the kick was legal. Now, Mr. Miyagi also stole a black belt so Daniel LaRusso could fight in the tournament. That's probably not legal. Why isn't anyone talking about that? Because it's a movie. And the other thing is, no one was not rooting for Daniel LaRusso in 1984.
Okay, I can't top that. So, one more round of applause here. And so we have volunteers coming down here with microphones. If you would please wait until it gets to you, and if you raise your hands, and I will call on people.
You said no students are bad, but their teachers are. So in Cobra Kai, Miguel basically injured someone like on their injury, which was Robbie. So would you consider Johnny Lawrence a bad teacher?
I thought it was going to be a softball. I really did.
What is this, Oprah? Okay, good question. No, I mentioned earlier that the intentions are always good. I think early in the season, sometimes falling forward is another thing I mentioned. You know, so we trip, we fall, we skin our knees, we scrape our hands. But I think Johnny Lawrence is a work in progress. So we'll give him a pass here and there. You've watched subsequent seasons. He's really trying to straighten his life out.
Can I be the Karate Kid?
What did he say? What did he say?
Can I be a Karate Kid?
Can you be the Karate? You are the Karate Kid. You are right now, today. You're awesome. That's amazing.
I heard on one of the interviews that you said that you still had the yellow car from the Karate Kid. Do you still have it? And if so, do you ever drive it around the neighborhood?
Okay.
And what are the responses if you do drive it?
It would be fun, right? I do have that car, the exact car that was in the movie. Columbia Pictures gave me that car. I begged them for it, but then they gave it to me. And then it became this white elephant or yellow elephant that sat in storage on four flats as my acting career sort of dipped a little bit. And then we pumped up the tires and I started working again. What's interesting about it is the producers of Cobra Kai took that car, put a new engine in it, brought it down to our location, and it's still there, and we use it in the Cobra Kai show. So anytime you see that car in Cobra Kai, it is the car that Miyagi gives to Daniel today. So I can't wait to drive it down Broad Street.
I'm testing for my junior black belt in 2 weeks. Is there any advice you would give?
Wait, did you? I didn't get that. I'm sorry.
He's trying out for his junior black belt in 2 weeks. Any advice?
First of all, between the two of us, you're the martial artist. I think, stay focused, trust your sensei and your parents and the people you care about, and you are going to sail through it. I mean, you're awesome. Thank you so much. Good luck, man. Good luck.
Out of all the Karate Kid movies, if you could do it all over again, which one would you do, maybe with some creativity and innovation, and why?
Of all the moves, which one would I do again or do over? It's interesting, man. That's a great question. And I instinctively would answer, I would not do over the original Karate Kid again, because I there's a scene or two, and I write to one scene that I would have loved to have another shot at. So I don't want to kill that story for you, but it's small. But that movie is nearly, look at what it's given us. So I'm not gonna do that over. And I did enjoy the Okinawa, the part two, very much. I love that film. I love the Tamlin Tomita, who played Kumiko, and Yuji Okamoto. I mean, is he the MVP of season five, Chosen? He's amazing. I would normally say I would like to have them rewrite Karate Kid 3 to make it a better movie. Because I still feel that. I feel it didn't forward the Daniel LaRusso character, and it sort of repeated the first movie and got a little cartoon-like. That being said, if we didn't have that Terry Silver and we didn't have the Robin Lively and Mike Barnes that are now so awesome in Cobra Kai, maybe Cobra Kai doesn't go on as long with as much great stories. So I think everything was done right, even though a lot of people say, so now with Cobra Kai season 4 and 5, introducing all the Karate Kid 3 characters. Do you like the movie now? Huh, Ralph? Do you like the movie? And I'm like, no, I still don't love the movie, but I'm really happy that I get to work with these great actors again and sort of build on maybe some of the shortcomings become the fruit of today. It's really, it's a blessing. It's a gift that keeps on giving. I don't know how to explain it besides that.
After filming the Karate Kid movies, did you completely give up martial arts? And if so, what was it like getting back into it for Cobra Kai?
Yeah, it was. I studied a little for the first film. I had about 5 weeks of training. The second, I had more. And so you just play to your strengths. I did not, in between films and after, I didn't stick with it. I kind of wish I did, because once Cobra Kai came about 30 years later, it wasn't like riding a bike. Everything hurt. It's more, you know, it's about stretching and injury prevention as you get older. That's the thing. You don't snap back, man. I would like do a scene, bam, 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 let's go again. I like do one kick. Okay, two kicks at a time. Isn't it lunch yet? No, I mean, we work really hard and we don't have the time on Cobra Kai that we had on Karate Kid. Karate Kid, we had John Avildsen would work those fight scenes and have us rehearse them in practice in between everything. It never, and I write about that in the Becoming the Kid chapter, how he would never, it would never be ready. You always had to do more. With Cobra Kai, sometimes we literally making it up on the day because we don't have the time. And so then it's about injury prevention. It's tougher to move like you did when you were 21. It definitely is. But, you know, that's part of the, there's a little bit of a heightened element to Cobra Kai anyway, you know. And so you get to have a little bit of that. It's authentic. The kids are awesome. The kids in the Cobra Kai, I mean, none of them are martial artists. And they're, well, Jacob is Hawk, Eli, incredible. And Tanner Buchanan, incredible. The work, Mary Mauser, what she's done, she never couldn't touch her toes in the first season. And last season, she's doing so much stuff. So thank God for the kids, is what I'm saying.
So if you got to do over any fight in Cobra Kai, which fight would it be?
If I get to do over any fight in Cobra Kai, which the fight that I always felt that they were trying to write for me in season two, it never worked. It was on the beach. It was a scene where, you know, Robbie is, I'm forgetting the exact setup for the scene, but it was a scene on the beach. It was supposed to be a pretty big fight for Daniel, and it never worked at the level. There was one kick in there, but we never shot it. You know, doing the fight scenes is, you know, being able to do it physically is important, but if the camera isn't placed in the right spot, you don't capture it as well. I mean, you look at the crane kick in the original film, that camera angle just made it such a heroic moment, and you got to see the beauty and the cinematic beauty of it. If that camera was at a different angle, you wouldn't see that, you know. So that scene, there was a scene on the beach in Cobra Kai season two that fell short, and we wound up in season four. There's a hockey fight where I fight like five guys. That was the let's do this right version, and we were able to do it.
Out of all three Karate Kid films, which was your favorite villain?
The first one. It's, you know, that's where the magic happened. You know, that's where you learn about Miyagi, his backstory, the World War II, the internment camps, all that stuff that becomes more than just, you know, fighting for the soul of the valley, which is awesome. But it had, you needed all that stuff underneath it to care. And it's waxing cars and painting fences work. It's magic, you know.
So I remember you saying you grew up loving The Outsiders, which was one of my favorite books. Did you always feel connected to Johnny reading it? And did you want to play him? Was he your first choice to play?
He was the only choice for me. It was interesting. You know, when I read that book, like I said, I was 12 years old. It was seventh grade English. And it was the first book that I read without my parents saying, okay, you have to read another chapter tonight. I was not a great reader, but that one just sucked me in. And I felt, you know, it was written by Essie Hinton, was a 16-year-old girl. She wrote that book. I was just with her in Tulsa, Oklahoma about 2 weeks ago doing this same thing. It was awesome. I connected to Johnny. My life was very different. He was from a broken home and very, very tough upbringing. And I did not have that. I had a pretty close-knit upbringing. But I connected with, he was the smallest in the class. He had dark, dark eyes and black hair and was the runt of the litter and wanted to, you know, felt his family was his friends. And I just kind of felt for him. And he's a sympathetic character. And then at the end, he gets to, you know, I don't want to ruin the in the book, but he's a tragic character, but he has poignant and profound things to say, and he's the best character in the book, in the movie, in my opinion. No, Pony Boy's up.
By the way, I apologize for not being S.E. Hinton tonight, but I have noticed a phenomenon. How many people specifically in seventh grade English read that book?
Me too. Amazing.
I know it's the oddest thing, seventh grade.
Hey, Ralph, how's it going?
Oh, I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. So can you talk a little bit about how cinema has changed from, you know, from the 80s until now? I feel like, I'm an aspiring filmmaker just as a hobby, but like, I feel like there were more quality movies back then, and now there's more quantity and I'm seeing less quality. So if you can give advice on that and how, like, you've seen some changes over the years, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, what's happening, certainly from movies, you know, I mean, there was no such thing as, you know, Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. You know, but movies, by virtue of the business of it all, I mean, this is pre-pandemic, so that's added another dimension to getting people out of the house. When you have when you go watch your content on your phone, which the younger generation does for the most part, you know, we've gotten so used to, you know, immediacy. You want to watch it at that moment. It's not like, you know, you wait for the movie to come out, or if it's your favorite show, you know, even now, if HBO has a show come out once a week, I'm like, I got to wait another week for an episode? And that's the way it always was. But the content has become so tentpole, big, multiverse, you know, louder, bigger, funnier, where movies, if you say quality, I mean, I think I looked at I did a thing for Turner Classic Movies last month where I had to pick three classic films out. And the ones I did was Network, which is just a phenomenal film written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. And then I picked Rebel Without a Cause, and I picked Singing in the Rain, which is still the greatest musical. It's just incredible. I mean, that movie is really incredible. But the stories about, you know, Network is really about behavior and character and personalities, which is something we find more in television or streaming services, if you say Succession or Game of Thrones. I'm just pulling a bunch out of the hat. And so I think movies have changed. I think the most refreshing thing was with Top Gun this summer, because it did kind of everything right, and it felt like yesterday and today at the same time, which is interesting what Cobra Kai does with the Karate Kid universe. So I think there's hope there. It's interesting, you wonder if the Karate Kid, that movie script, would be a movie today. Would it be a major motion picture? Maybe not. It might be like a Family Channel movie or something, or who knows? You know, so it's different. I miss being able to just go to a movie and just see a story about behavior and personality, or a movie like Coda, which won the Academy Award this year, right? That's a great film that reminded me of the movies of yesterday. You know, but I'm the old guy now, so of course I'm going to say that.
Is Karate Kid coming to Broadway, musical?
Yes, I saw Robert Kamen, who wrote the original Karate Kid film and crafted all those characters, has written a musical, and he wrote the book. And I went to see it in St. Louis. They're out of town, and it's really wonderful. They're still working on certain elements of it. They just had meetings in New York City to find a theater. So it's never over with this franchise.
No. You mentioned Back to the Future in the book. I saw Back to the Future, the musical, in London.
Yep.
Mind-blowing.
Right.
Hi. What made you decide to publish your memoir compared to like publishing it like 10 years ago?
What made me decide to write the book now as opposed to 10 years ago? I was actually thinking about it probably about the last 8 years. A couple of publishing companies and literary book agents came to me and said, would you ever write about making that film? I think Cary Elwes had a hit with a book about The Princess Bride. So they were, you know, talking to me about that. I just didn't know quite what I wanted it to be, and this was before Cobra Kai. I could just write about making a movie, but I wanted the story to go into my personal life. And then what happened with Cobra Kai, now it all of a sudden became not only timely, but more relevant, because like I mentioned, even the stuff with my kids and how something from yesterday is relevant today, to have both nostalgia and something current at the same time, and then talk about how that has affected my life all of a sudden became a rich idea. And then the world shut down with the COVID, and I'm sitting and I'm saying, maybe I should write something because I can't leave the house. And I started jotting down chapter titles, Becoming the Kid, Strawberry Shortcake and the Cannoli, which is Macchio and Elizabeth Shue. And then the Frozen in Time, what it's been like to be someone who's attached to something at a specific time who chose not to age till recently. And then I started jotting that stuff down, and then paragraphs came from there, and that became the blueprint. And in essence, that the book proposal is, in essence, exactly what I was able to lay down here. So, and it's so awesome to see go on. You know, you try not to Google yourself, but I go on, I check out the reviews of the book and from the fans, and, you know, I'm feeling really, humbled and proud that it kind of struck that chord of the honest conversation that I was going for.
We're glad you did that instead of baking sourdough.
Yeah.
Like everybody, okay, back there.
What was it like stepping back into the role of Daniel Russo after all those years? And what role did the episode of How I Met Your Mother play into the coming back of Cobra Kai?
Yeah, I think I write a decent amount about the How I Met Your Mother of it all and the Barney Stinson theory that Johnny Lawrence is the real Karate Kid, not the nerd from Jersey. But it's great. It didn't, you know, if you ask the writers of Cobra Kai, they were working on a Karate Kid, continuation for years before the How I Met Your Mother. But it only shows that it was a good idea. But the Barney Stinson of it all, I write in a chapter called Theories and Debates and the Birth of Cobra Kai. Talk about all that stuff. It's really fun and so well done on with what they do with How I Met Your Mother. Jumping back in the shoes of Daniel Russo, yeah, I was a little nervous at first. I'm like, how am I going to do this? What's he going to be like? And I started talking to the writers about what the expectations were. And they were just go with your instincts. This is what we decided. Whatever I did back in 83 when I shot the movie, I was just going to bring that to the table in 2018, which is when we did the first season. And what happens is just by living life and having that wisdom under me, or that experience of being a husband and being a father of two, and all those things just come to the table naturally. Knowing William Zabka for that long, and just, it wasn't about finding the new character. The struggles for Daniel Russo and me in season one was because I had to be a little bit of an antagonist, probably more than he would have been, just to set up the concept of the show. So that was a little more challenging for me, but I fortunately the show kept going on, and now I got to, you know, get past the, like, hey, I kicked his face, you know? Okay, I was like, really? I have to say, I kicked his face? Yeah, it's funny. And they were right. It was funny.
Do you still have the black and white headband from Cobra Kai?
I still have the headband from Cobra Kai? The Karate Kid headband, right? Yes, I have the original headband from, these are the things I kept from the original movie. The headband and the final tournament scene. There were a few of them we had, but I have the original one. I brought that on the Tonight Show in the first season of Cobra Kai, and that was a big deal. Like Jimmy Fallon's like, can I touch it? I was like, no, you can't touch it. You haven't earned that. And I kept the trophy, the All Valley Under 18 Karate Trophy. I have that. And there's pictures of that in your book. If you open up your hymnals to page 120. There's a picture of the trophy and the headband in the book in my house. And then I have the 1947 Ford convertible. So I made out pretty good. I kept stuff from the Outsiders, too. And my cousin Vinny, I kept a can of tuna. But I haven't opened it.
So. This all has to go to the Smithsonian.
Out of every fight scene you filmed in Karate Kid and Cobra Kai, which one was your favorite?
I would say that it's tough to say, now I'm going through a bunch of them, but the final fight with Johnny Lawrence in the original Karate Kid is a great fight. It's just paced well, it's edited beautifully by John Avildsen, and the music by Bill Conti, and just, it really is cinematic, and you're feeling everything. You're feeling every hit. You know, obviously that movie's very black and white, so you're rooting for the guy in white and rooting against the guy in black. And now you flip to, you know, the fight at the fence in the original movie is a good fight. I mean, I'm just getting my ass kicked, but it's really a good fight. Cobra Kai, I would say the hockey fight was a lot of fun for me. It really was. But the sort of rematch with Billy in season 4, we worked really hard. It was freezing. It was like, you know, 28, 32 degrees in Atlanta at night in early February. And we're shooting this scene, trying not to pull hamstrings and groin muscles because we were, you know. I think we did a good job with that scene. Terry Silver fights this season 5 were pretty cool. One, when he beat the hell out of me, and two, when I finally get back at him. So those were fun as well. I could go on and on.
So this lady is also going to pull something if she doesn't ask her
question. Okay, that's
so, and so you better make it a good one. You're the last one here.
Thank you so much.
It's upside down, ma'am, the microphone.
I'm so nervous.
You're
excited. Hi.
I've done it before.
So, hello. I've been a fan of yours since you played Jeremy Andretti in Eight is Enough. And
that's a day oneer right there.
Yes. My question is, how did you get to that point? We know you successful. Most of the people in here know you then. But how did you get to that point as someone who wasn't in Hollywood, mm-hmm. and then you're on TV? And was your family supportive of your choice to go that route?
Yeah, great question. You'll see in the book, when I was a young kid, I wanted to be Gene Kelly. That's why I picked Singing in the Rain. I thought Gene Kelly was the coolest. When I used to come home from school, 5, 6 years old, my mom had, in New York, it was like the $1 million movie or the 4:30 movie on, and it would always be these great movie musicals. And I think my mom, there was a bug in her that maybe she, you know, she's a big Betty Grable fan. I'm really dating myself now. But so she had a wish fulfillment of that and never did. And I wanted to, so I took tap dance lessons when I was a little kid. And I was on stage in the shows at school. I was never the lead, but I was, you know, was third guy from the left in the back or whatever. And then I do a little dance number in the middle of it. I was the youngest looking, you know. And so I enjoyed the footlights. I even feel it right here. I just enjoy, you know, the feedback I get from the audience. So that's where that sort of storytelling and love affair came from, watching those movies and getting on stage at a young age. And then I got a Bubble Yum commercial. I don't know if anybody knows. You can watch it on YouTube. It's totally embarrassing. So I'll go home and look up Machio Bubble Yum and just laugh at me.
She's seen it. She's
it. Yeah, I've been. And then Robert Downey Sr., who, you know, is Downey's dad, was directing a movie called Up the Academy. And I went into an audition just based on the Bubble Yum commercial that I got by, you know, singing and dancing to Bubble Gum. And I got that part. It was a character by the name of Chooch Bombalazzi. It's a mob kid. I mean, it was like it was sort of a Mad Magazine academy, you know, military academy movie. Silly, rated R, whatever. It got me to the next stop, which was Joyce Selznick, a casting director in New York City, was looking for ABC, what they do now with like Disney Channel and Nickelodeon, looking for young talent. And I guess they were looking for a Scott Baio type. I don't know. To plug and play, and they put me as on Eight is Enough, and I was 9 was Too Many, and it was canceled. But no, those are my jokes, folks, all night. How I got here. That's how I got here.
Well, speaking of audience reactions, yes. Come on, really give it up for your friend and your sensei, Ralph Macchio.
Awesome. You guys are great.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.